chair. We're so glad to have you join us here on the Back Porch Education Podcast. For the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about all things educational. It's a wonderful day to learn something. Glad you could join us.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. I'm Jason, one half of the podcast, and I'm here with my buddy Steve. We're talking about the future of education and why we're excited about it as a couple of teachers. And last time we focused on new tech and how technology is going to play a huge role in the future of education. And we left one big sort of aspect of that conversation unscathed, and that is the conversation of AI, how artificial intelligence is going to impact us as teachers and students. We have all sorts of interesting questions there, like, can machines replace humans? Should they replace humans? Can a machine teach humans humanely? We have all kinds of stuff going on there, but we're going to hop over that discussion for today, and instead we're going to focus on this generational gap that everybody talks about, and we're going to talk about how people of different generations can participate in education and why that's good or bad. So today, for you guys, I have a wonderful little 8-line poem by Robert Frost entitled, What 50 Said. When I was young, my teachers were the old. I gave up fire for form till I was cold. I suffered like a metal being cast. I went to school to age to learn the past. Now that I'm old, my teachers are the young. What can't be molded must be cracked and sprung. I strain at lessons fit to start a suture. I go to school to youth to learn the future.
Well, that's a great poem, Jason. Glad to be back with you on the podcast. I go to school to youth to learn the future. Jesus, I think, said out of the mouth of babes, right? We recognize that each generation asks questions of itself, but much more importantly, of the previous generation, to try and clarify where things are going. And that can be a wonderful exercise in dialectic. It can also be the basis of revolutions. So I think it's an exciting aspect of teaching that there are certain things that I don't think change about the activity of teaching, and yet we're constantly finding that the receiver of education is facing new issues, facing different times, changing in their appetites culturally. There is no static culture. It's either improving or dying off. And so I think this is a great topic for us today. And I kind of start us off, I guess, with a question. What is eternal or timeless about teaching? Are there things that you can think of that just are always going to be true before we talk about those things that maybe are changing?
Yeah, man. When we're talking about what's eternal or what's timeless, I don't know that I have a bullet point list or anything like that, but what comes to mind immediately is, you know, what a couple of my teaching mentors taught me. And that is, thinking about the teacher and the relationship that he or she has with his or her student. And, you know, that relationship is one of trust. It's a growing relationship, you know. I think in particular, the three things that never change: a teacher must love the subject, and the teacher must love his students, And not in this order, but the third thing is a teacher must know the subject.
Right, right. And as we were talking about last time, simply knowing facts is probably not nearly as important as having experience with that subject and having yourself as teacher started drawing lines, you know, connecting the dots. We sometimes say that using, and I don't just mean in a practical way, I mean playing around in your mind with a subject enough to where that joy is there. You know kind of what it can do and what some of the interesting questions are about it. And then bringing that out, I'm almost making it into a material thing here, but bringing an idea or a subject or some focus of learning out onto the floor of the classroom and everybody kind of cross-legged sitting around playing with it, I don't think that's ever going to change. Mm-hmm. Wonder, curiosity, questioning things. That's just always going to be part of human learning.
Right.
And the interesting thing to me about this topic or why it's so exciting to be looking to the future is that all too often we forget the fun new things that can be learned by that and tend to want to cling to the old way in the sense, well, when I was in school, this is how I learned.
Right.
Thinking that experience has to be repeated in order for learning to be repeated. And it really doesn't. As was talked about last time, that just the technology alone is radically different. I was thinking after our last conversation, you know, what's it like in the 16th century when suddenly books are available when before they really weren't? Now you can print these books, you can put them in everybody's hands. And of course, we know that just a while later, you have revolutions being spawned by the ease with which newspapers and tracts and pamphlets and booklets can be put into people's hands. Brand new technology, radically changing the way in which people were able to converse with one another.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. That had to be, we talk about the printing press, how awesome it was and all that sort of thing. But I think it's hard for us to imagine how much that changed the world when all of a sudden sources were available that were never available before. And yet that's sort of what we're experiencing now. You know, we are once again, it's sort of the new printing press, right? People talk about the internet as the second printing press. We have now sources that are available that we, you know, that people 100 years ago couldn't even imagine having. And it's really a boon to the educator and his pupils because, man, we get to reap that fruit.
While this show is a back porch discussion, it does cost a little bit of money. So if you're liking what you hear, consider helping us out. You can simply use the donation button on the website to send along a one-time gift, or we have subscriber plans for those who want to commit to regular support. Subscribers can get premium rewards depending on how nice a chair you pull up on the porch. We have everywhere from sitting on the floor to our finest rocking chair available. But whatever you can do, know that it helps us keep the conversation going. And for that, we heartily thank you. Well, on the flip side, Jason, there's this whole question. If we're asking what's timeless and enduring in education, why not contemplate for a minute or two what things are up for grabs? What could change across generations or even quicker than that? Are there things in teaching that are just of the moment? And if so, what are those things that we should consider? You know, we have the ability to toss it aside because it's just fit the moment.
Sure. You know, I have a great example of that because it was something that was taught to me, you know, what, 15 years ago, like it was the future that I was always going to need it. And that is keyboarding class, right? So as a seventh grader, I went in and learned how to type on a computer, and it was heralded as this thing that was going to be amazing for me, that I had to learn how to type because that was the future. That's where everything was going to be. That's what everyone was going to be doing. And I will admit, it helped me tremendously through high school and college. I'm really glad that I took a keyboarding class in seventh grade. But that even that now, we sort of are talk to text is even getting rid of that idea to some extent, or not that idea, rather that skill to some extent. And, you know, I wonder in 10 years from now, how much we're going to be typing. Maybe a lot, maybe not at all, but I think that's one thing that eventually will go the way of the dodo bird.
Yeah. Well, here's where our generational differences come. I of course took typing class with a typewriter.
A what?
Once upon a time, a typewriter. It was an interesting box that had keys on it.
Huh.
And you actually had to load paper up in it. And,
wow.
You know, I can remember the teacher scaring us all. In order to pass the class, we had to be able to type 35 words a minute without any mistakes.
Uh-huh.
And, I passed the class typing 60 words a minute and was quite happy with the fact that I could manipulate a keyboard in that way.
Sure.
My sons, none of them, I don't believe any of a couple of them were introduced to Mavis Beacon on the internet, you know, to try and help them. But most of that was me trying to cling to something I thought they needed. As they have said to me many times, I don't use 10 fingers. I use 2 thumbs, Dad, and that's really all I need. And it boggles my mind that so many students these days seem to be moving towards, you know, typing on a screen such as in an iPad, which I find to be difficult, but they do it.
Right.
Or many of them, you know, the old cartoon, think of an essay as just a really long text to young people trying to explain to each other what an essay was. and one of them is sitting there with the 2 thumbs on the screen typing on his phone. And my assumption is that he's typing his essay into his iPhone so he can turn it in electronically to his teacher. And I just, that to anyone over the age of 30, that seems absurd. Why would they do it that way? The old way is so much superior. But this is where we get caught in education is trying to distinguish, I could have a long argument with somebody about the fact that the way in which information enters the mind through the hand that is writing it on paper versus the fingers that are typing it into a keyboard is different.
Sure.
That's not the same process. It's not doing the same thing to the brain. It's not learning in the same way. I think having both present is better than just one or the other, but I can stand on both sides of that argument. And on the one hand, argue harshly that it, who knows what's next. Like you're saying, that it might be the voice activated text that's next. It could be stuff we can't even imagine.
Right.
That's why I'm back on the timeless thing is they're going to need words and they're going to need numbers no matter what the education is like, because our brains are wired that way. But the way in which we manipulate those symbols, you know, is going to be different. Calculators came into being, and the first calculator I ever saw was seventh grade, and it was about the size of a Buick, and it had to be plugged in, and it could add, subtract, multiply, and divide, and that's it.
Sure.
The next one I saw had a square root feature on it, and that was mind-blowing.
Right.
And now I have to help enforce rules about these complex calculators that seem almost obsolete now that we have apps for that on the iPads.
Yeah.
But they have games and they have, you know, it's just crazy how quickly and how not just the rapidity of it, but the amount, the step, the giant step between that Texas Instruments instrument in the mid 70s and a free app on your iPhone today. There's just no comparison between the two other than that they both involve numbers and rather quick computing, much faster than I can do in my head.
Right. And man, it's really wild to think about how they say that technology is not only going fast, but that it's accelerating, right? So that the jump between now and 10 years from now will be greater than the jump between 10 years ago and now. And it really is a crazy thing to think about. You know, what are we doing today that we won't be doing 10 years from now? I mean, will the iPad be obsolete in 10 years?
Right, right.
I don't know.
Well, that's the fun. That's why I think looking to the future can be fun.
Right.
We're going to have to approach it on whatever principles we can derive from the past.
Yep.
We only live in the moment for that moment, and then it's history. And again, the crystal ball is missing, so we can't look into the future and see what it's going to be. So we're going to use the past to approach whatever we have in the future. I don't want it to get us bogged down in wishing it was just like the past, but we don't know what it holds. And I know a lot of people are concerned that somehow machinery, this is what we skipped over, and we'll get back to it on some future podcast, but artificial intelligence is always going to be scary to real intelligence. It'll be faster. It'll be shinier. It will push, especially someone with any age at all on them, out into the scary edges. But we're moving, as you said, exponentially faster every day towards whatever that future is. And I think another aspect of this for us about the future is the fact that when one generation comes into school, they're judging what that older generation calls great teaching. And I like the fact that as we spread out across the globe I can now be taught by people around the globe online, I think that affects things. You know, back in the day, you walked into a classroom and that's the teacher you got. Better or worse, right. They're the only one teaching math at this middle school, so that's my math teacher.
Right.
I think it's an interesting aspect that the market can now dictate, hey, there's this really good math teacher online. Maybe I'll learn my math from them and fall asleep in boring or bad math teacher's class and not lose out on an education because I can get it online. But even as I say that sounds somewhat scary. Let's take a brief break and come back, see what we can do to wrap up this stuff. Hey, during this brief break, I wanted to encourage you to use the share buttons we have on our website in order to help us get folks tuned into the show. Our goal is to encourage as many educators, homeschoolers, NFL punters, and donut makers as we can with these podcasts. So help us get the word out. Share our Facebook page. Send folks a link to one of your favorite episodes. Do whatever you can to help us share this craziness with either your best friends or, if it's more appropriate, your worst enemies. We will love you all the more for sharing our love. Thanks. And now, back to the show.
Okay, so Steve, we were just talking. You kind of finished up there talking about an interesting idea that I think is coming fast, this idea of the marketplace, really options, you know, options for students and parents. And I think for teachers, there's some fear there. Some of it is probably well-placed, especially for poor teachers. But it's also going to be a good thing for a lot of teachers, too, this idea of students and parents being able to choose. You know, the marketplace is scary. Democracy is scary because we can think as teachers, well, oh, great, now I have to not only be smart and helpful and a good teacher, but I also have to be entertaining. I have to appeal to the masses and, you know, make them feel good if I'm going to make any money or something like that. It's a scary trail to go down, but I think it's something that we're going to have to think through, and to dispel the fear, where we need to start is asking ourselves, what sort of teacher is going to do best in the marketplace, or not necessarily in the marketplace, but just in the future of education when students and parents have options? What kind of teacher is going to do best there?
Well, I think that at the heart of this podcast is the answer to that, but to much in education, and that's courage or confidence, the opposite of fear.
Yeah,
there's so much in our society today that is motivated from coming from this very negative place of fear. My kid won't get the best education. My kid is going to be behind. My kid is not going to get into college. We don't have to spell out the fears. Everybody knows them.
Right.
And the best teachers, I think, are those who come in the room with some gravity, recognizing that what we're studying is worth studying, but in particular, with the proper understanding, not of amusement or entertainment, but of humor.
Yeah.
That, sure. That as humans, we can approach anything. We've been given by God this blessing of intelligence and curiosity and imagination, and that if we unleash those things, that to me is one of the biggest problems in education today, is that it isn't very imaginative. It's coming off the textbook. It's aimed at a test. It's sort of in a rut. And so one of the exciting things is kids are saying, look, I'm tired of learning that way. Help me think. Help me see it in a new way. Let's find some new wine and some new wineskins and see how this works. And I think that's a marvelous thing. And the whatever dispels fear, obviously having the truth and loving it, being passionate about it, is going to do that. But that confidence in the fact that there is some things that are unchanging that can gear us, tool us to go into whatever the future holds, as scary as that may be, that confidence is going to be what I think students are going to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm shaking my head up and down vigorously as you're talking, because I'm in agreement, and this fear is warranted in some places, but I think it kind of grows and becomes a beast that if you're not careful, you can't get it off your back. Man, humor goes a long way in reducing our anxieties and, I would say, reorienting ourselves to reality. Another big thing, you know, we can obviously talk about perfect love casting out fear, and how, as teachers, loving our subjects, loving our students, how that's going to help, although that's not really what we're after when we're talking about perfect love. I think it is analogous, even if it's not the same. But another big thing that I think is going to be crucial for teachers is something that has always been crucial for teachers, and that's humility.
Right. It's interesting that humor and humility are coming out of the same. They're both coming from a place of earth. Humus, right, in the Latin, this notion of dirt. And that I'm not saying that the humor has to be dirty, but it has to be real,
right,
of nature,
yeah,
from the soil. And humility recognizes we're but dust and come from the soil.
Right.
And I think that's
right.
A bad teacher lacks that.
Absolutely.
They think they know it all. They have very little humor. You little brats need to learn this stuff. And the most engaging teachers are those who almost lose sight that they're the teacher
Yes.
And it's much more that they're one of the students, not at a maturity level, but as teacher and student look together at the third point of that triangle, the subject, the teacher is much more like the student towards the subject than a know-it-all.
He's
still got way more to learn. And I think that that's important. And you bring up the issue of individuality. This is going back to our discussion of tech. One of the challenges for technological advancement in education is keeping it personal. The fact that a MOOCs class can enroll 1,500 students from around the world to hear Professor so-and-so teach about such-and-such has some real advantages, but what kind of individuated, personal, straight-from-the-teacher interaction are those 1,500 students going to get? I mean, next to none, right?
So, well, yeah, how could they?
One of the issues that education faces is that the more it tries to be efficient and get as many people through as possible, we talked about this in the last podcast, my mother's experience with the baby boom, and suddenly I have twice as many students in my class. If efficiency is what we're driving at, that's a different thing, and there's ways in which technology can help with that efficiency. The fact that I can give an online assignment and it rolls right into my grade book without me ever having to pick up a pen or even do any data entry is wonderful for me when it comes to choosing between grading and Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
But it's also possible that those grades sliding into the grade book like that without me really even having to pay attention to them means that I won't pay attention to them and see that Johnny failed the test and needs some help.
Right.
So,
well, and if we're not careful,
there's a trade-off with all these things.
Don't you think? Yeah. We can't get into it right now, but I think there's a real danger in letting things become other things. I mean, a grade, if one of your students receives a grade and you have not seen their work, at that point, I mean, that is a far cry from what a grade was when it was developed, you know.
Right.
Regardless of, I mean, I'm not even a big fan. I think there are serious problems with grades anyway, but I'm just saying that is a new level that it's fallen to, you know? So yeah, a lot's out there and a lot's happening. But I think that, Steve, we're going to have to wrap it up this time and say goodbye. So until next time, man, I appreciate it.
Great. Good talking to you. Let's go eat.
Well, thanks again for joining us in this great conversation about education. We hope you will not just listen, but participate. Leave us a comment, suggestion, or thought on our website. You just never know when we'll use it on the show. Until next time, pursue joy and learn something.